So good to have you all here. Thanks for coming. We're going to be talking about the process of development, and I think you'll find that to be kind of an interesting exercise. There's a lot of ground to cover in a relatively short amount of time, so we need to get going. Does anyone need notes? Okay, we need a set. Anybody else? They should be in your, if you signed up for this in preparation for the seminar, you should have had it included in your notebook. Why don't we begin with prayer and ask the Lord's blessing upon our time together, and then we'll get right into the material for this session. Father in heaven, thank you for your goodness to us. And thanks for the privilege of being here. Thanks for the strength to get through these days. They've been long days, and they've been so informing and so helpful to our ministries as we really try to reflect on how we might more effectively be used of you. And so, Lord, we would pray that you'd keep us alert during this hour and that we might gain something that would be of real value to us as we seek to fulfill the mission to which we've been called. We thank you for the time. We commit it to you, and we pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Development, this is a field where I've spent the good part of my life, 35 years exactly, this fall. And for 35 years, I've worked with organizations and ministries in helping them to build infrastructure to support what it is that they're doing. You know, for all the things that we learn and for all the things that we gain from attending a session like this, the realities are if we don't have a platform from which to share it, then obviously its impact upon others is going to be marginalized. And so what it is that development does is basically provide a means for which or upon which you can build a ministry. And what I've discovered that of all the things that development does include, they can be narrowed down into five specific models that can be really helpful, I think, in just guiding us in the way that we do things. And the model that I'd like to share with you today is the process of development, because it's kind of the core model around which this whole developmental process revolves. There are five steps in it. We're going to kind of work through those steps. We'll try to do it relatively quickly so that we can have time for some questions towards the end of our time together and try to amplify and spend a little bit more time hopefully clarifying some issues that might emerge out of this discussion. So that's kind of where we're going. The first step of this five-step process of development, and let me just back up long enough to say that we define development, or I define development, so let me give you a definition so that it's really clear what it is that we're talking about. As I define development as the things that we do within our organizations to build what I call rational relationships with others. In other words, that the ultimate goal of development is to build relationships with individuals, because it's in the context of relationship that everything flourishes. So I'm absolutely convinced that our ministries will grow, our ministries will flourish proportional to our ability to be able to build relationships with other people. And so development is all about relationships. It has very little to do with money. It has very little to do with what you have to say. But the realities are, to the degree that we build relationships, it seems that we don't lack for money, nor do we lack for people who will really respond to us in meaningful ways, ways consistent with our desires for them as we seek to reach out and to minister to their needs. And so relationships are so very important. And one of the things that I often like to do with individuals is I like to, you know, have them think about a relationship that's very special to them. You know, maybe it's your best friend or someone that you've grown to love over the years, perhaps your spouse or someone that when you think of best friend and when you think of somebody that you would want to go to if you were experiencing a special need, you know, who would you think of? And then what would be some of the words that you would use to describe them? Now, you know, in the interest of time, let me suggest to you what typically some of those responses are. Some people will say, well, gee, I describe my best friend as someone with whom I have a lot of fun. I just enjoy being with them. We communicate well. I mean, there's nothing that's hidden between my best friend and me. We can talk about anything, and I realize that regardless of how acceptable I may perceive myself to be at any given time, The realities are I'm always accepted by my friends. They love me, and I realize that I may not be lovable sometimes, but I know that they'll accept me for who it is I am. And they love me, and we can talk freely. We have fun together. There are all kinds of things that we would use to describe, you know, those very, very special friendships. You know, the question becomes, would you think those would be the same words that individuals with whom you're building relationship in your organization would use to describe their relationship with you as an organization? You know, I think we think about relationships and we talk about relationships a lot in ministry. But I think, you know, it's a concept that we feel comfortable about talking, but practically we don't always do the things that we need to be doing to build those kinds of relationships that have been so special to us with the individuals that are supporting us. And so what development is all about is building relationships. Now, there's another word in that definition that I gave you. It's the things that we do to build rational relationships with people. And the point that I want to make there is that relationships kind of move through a process. I think a great analogy of building relationships or development is falling in love. You see, we fall in love. We're drawn to someone emotionally. I can remember the very first day I ever met my wife, Sue, and I was attracted to her. She was attractive. She was she had braces on her teeth in those days, and she had long, dark hair, and she had an infectious smile, and she was witty and smart and obviously fun to be with, and I was really drawn to her emotionally. And through the process of time, we became better acquainted. I learned things about her family. I learned things about her. I learned about her desires. I learned about her longings and the things that she really wanted to accomplish in her life and so forth. And I really began to understand her a little bit more. I understood the essence of who she was. And we chose to marry, and I'm continuing to grow in that relationship and in my understanding of her, and you know, merging in ways that are very, very unique to the marriage situation, and just really growing, you know, constantly more in love with her. So while it's emotion that may bring us together into relationship, and that would be true between a person as well as an organization. See, people will generally, or you know, generally, be drawn to your ministry for emotional reasons. I mean, they look at what it is that you're doing to help people. They see the ministry of student ministry and the impact that it's having on the lives of people. They see that and they're emotionally moved. That's really good, and people are drawing those conclusions. That's really valuable, what it is this ministry is doing. And so they're drawn to you emotionally. Whether or not they will stay with you over the long term as lifelong partners in support of your ministry will really be determined on how well you build that relationship and they develop that rational understanding of all the things that are essential in order for that ministry to be successful. What do we need to do? You know, what is it that makes this thing work? And they need to understand, you know, a lot more about your organization than what is available to them at first glance. And so when we talk about development, we're talking about the things that we need to do to build these relationships. And the process of development, these five steps will kind of help you think through that. The first step in the process is identifying people with whom you'd like to build a relationship. you know, the whole focus of development needs to be targeted. You know, you don't just build relationships with, you know, the city in which you live. You don't build relationships with a particular congregation. But essentially what you do is you build relationships with individuals, don't you? People within congregations, people within the community where you provide your services and so forth. There are a couple of words that I have come to realize are pretty important to this discussion of identifying your prospects. Many years ago, I sat down with someone and they kind of drew these diagrams for me, and they were always very, very helpful to me. And I think they'll be informing and helpful to you as well. One time, probably 30 years ago, somebody sat down with me and they drew this picture and they said, "This stick person, you know, represents you. Each one of you, just put yourself there, and the circle represents your sphere of influence." You see, we all have a sphere of influence. We all have friends. Think of your sphere of influence in terms of the people that you might want to talk to if you had a great idea that you wanted to share with somebody. So you just want to, you just can't wait to share it. And so you go to your friends and say, "Momir, I got this great idea. Now you really need to hear it." And Momir may think, "Well, this is the craziest idea he's ever heard in his life." But I've earned the right to be heard with Momir because we're friends. We've known each other for a couple of years. And I know that he shares a lot of the same passions that I do and so forth. So I could share that with him because he's a part of my universe. So this term is oftentimes called universe. And basically, it represents the people in our lives with whom we have a very close relationship, people with whom we've earned the right to be heard. So it could include family members. It could include people with whom we work, people in the community that we know, people, you know, in our church that we know and are in relationship with and so forth. The point that I want to make is that the average universe of the average person in the world is about 40. That's on average. In other words, if you were to make a list of the people that were a part of your own sphere of influence, you'd probably come up with 30 or 40 names of individuals that you feel very, very comfortable with, people that you'd want to talk to if you were facing a crisis or if you wanted prayer or if you had an idea that you'd like to share. There's another term that we use in development that looks a little bit like this. In the middle of this circle, there's a building, and that building, let's say, represents your organization. It could be your church. It could be the ministry that you represent, the student movement that you're a part of, and so forth. And that movement or that ministry impacts groups of people. Now, if you think of the student ministry in which many of you are involved in the room and churches, there are various groups that are impacted by what it is that you do. Certainly students are impacted by what it is that you do, those students that are participating in your programs. Then you have, you might even have alumni, people who have been impacted by your ministry in the past. People that have been blessed by what it is that you do and have been touched in a very meaningful way by what it is that you do, that may not be with you in an active way now as they were years ago. Then you'd have perhaps extended family members of people that you have ministered to directly. In other words, they benefit kind of indirectly by what it is that you do. If your children go to a church that you minister to that family. If they're my children, let's say, this is my son and my daughter-in-law, and they go to your church and you're ministering to them, then I kind of benefit indirectly by what it is that you're doing. I'm grateful for you and the role that you're playing in the lives of somebody that's very, very close to me. So, and then you have other groups that may not even know that you exist, but yet they're groups that, by virtue of their geographic location to your ministry, might represent potential people with whom you'd like to build a relationship. I mean, that might be corporations or businesses that function in the communities where you provide, churches that benefit by your existence by virtue of the fact that you're ministering to people within those congregations. Wealthy people that live in your community that may not even know that you exist, but yet people who have capacity to help you and so forth. So these are what I call critical groups. And I want you to think of critical groups, and we're going to be talking more specifically about them a little bit later on, but I want you to think of a critical group as any group of people that you would perceive as being critical to your success. And these critical groups, obviously exist within the organization of which you're a part. And each one of these groups has people in it, don't they? In other words, you might say, well, we have student ministries. And so in the context of the ministry in Croatia, the student ministry in Croatia, there have been, 300 or 400 students that have been impacted, in one form or another by Momir's ministry in Croatia. Well, each one of those students has a universe of their own. They have a sphere of influence of their own. And so the term that's associated with this particular discussion is the term called market universe. And market universe basically is the size of your market. In other words, how do we begin this process of building development, programs, the kinds of things that we all do or we really have the need to do? Well, one of the things that we need to define is our market. How big is our market? And the market universe of an organization is, interestingly enough, calculable. If you really wanted to try to calculate the size of the market universe, you could determine, you know, first of all, what groups of people are you impacting either directly or indirectly or have the potential of impacting geographically? How many people are in those groups? And multiply, let's say you've got 400 students, and let's say that, you know, they're not, you know, maybe they have only 20 people in their universe. Well, that's 8,000. And then you can start adding these up, and you'll find that you have a market universe that's really quite large. And it's larger than what we typically think it might be. Now, that doesn't mean anything other than to say that you have a large universe, and I think what it means, practically speaking, is that we really don't probably lack the potential of being able to accomplish what it is that we need to accomplish. Now, there's a couple of things about identification of prospects that need to be remembered here, and that the first one is that a prospect really isn't a prospect until you have their names and addresses written down somewhere. In other words, we could say that we, you know, our ministry has a pretty large universe, a pretty large market universe, but a prospect isn't a prospect until you have their names and addresses, you know, in a database somewhere. And that you really have plans in place to begin cultivating relationships with these individuals that you've identified as people with whom you'd possibly like to build a relationship. And we'll talk more specifically about how we'd go about doing that in just a few seconds. So the first step in the developmental process is identifying your prospects. The second step is qualifying them. Now, think about falling in love, if we want to use that analogy, because it's a good developmental analogy. You know, not everybody that was of marital age of the opposite sex was essentially a prospect, somebody that you'd want to marry and spend the rest of your life with, right? I mean, we had ways of qualifying people. We'd certainly like somebody that we could, you know, that would be nice to look at the rest of our lives, and somebody that we could have a meaningful conversation with, somebody that had shared values. In other words, we wanted to make sure that we had things that we had in common. We probably wanted to determine whether or not our goals of life were compatible, because we certainly wouldn't want to have somebody that was planning to do something with their lives that was totally incompatible with where we wanted to go and so forth. And so there were things that we did, questions that we asked through the dating courtship process to try to really assess whether or not this is somebody we wanted to spend our lives with. And that's kind of qualification, isn't it? We qualified people. We do it in a variety of other ways. It so happens that if I look at your database, all the names of people with whom you have a relationship that are or basically with whom you'd like to build a relationship perhaps, and maybe somebody that's a donor or whatever, I kind of look through that list and I notice the names, the name of Bill Gates, let's say, then you might say, well, golly, if Bill Gates is one of the Jean supporters here, then the realities are he probably doesn't need much, you know, because here's the richest man on earth, you know. So we've qualified people, and we do it all the time. I mean, you do it every time you walk into a meeting. You come here and you see somebody and say, well, he's a teacher. So you've distinguished him among everybody else in the room by identifying him in the role that you see him fulfilling and the context of this particular conference, perhaps. Well, of all the ways, of all the people that you could possibly identify, let's say that we're just, you know, we really make it a point of beginning the process of identification of leaders or people with whom we'd like to build a relationship. Of all the people that you could possibly identify, they're going to fall in one of three broad categories. And so it's important to understand these categories. The first of the categories that they might fall into would be what I call a nuclear category. And what I mean by that is here are groups of individuals who benefit directly from the services that you provide. So there are groups that you are individuals that you could identify that would fall into groups of people who really benefit directly from the services you provide. In the case of student ministries, it would certainly be students, you know, who have participated in programs that your campus ministry offers. It would include alumni, people who have participated in those activities in the past. It would include volunteers, because they benefit directly from the services you provide. You're providing them an opportunity to participate in ministry, and so you know they're benefiting directly from your services. It may be the congregations or the churches, you know, in the area that basically have a large student population, you know, some of those students are part of your ministry, and so they benefit indirectly or directly from your services because you're ministering to a group of people that they are seeking to serve as well. So they benefit directly. Then you have another group of prospects down here that I call affinity prospects. And an affinity prospect is someone who benefits indirectly from the services you provide. In other words, you know, these people don't necessarily benefit directly, but there's some indirect benefit that they receive. So extended family members of people that you benefit directly, they would fall into that category. Grandparents, perhaps, aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews. All those groups may, in fact, benefit indirectly. Even neighbors, you know, interestingly enough, where we live and the people with whom we work, employers, you know, hopefully our ministry is accomplishing something significant in the lives of individuals to the point where, you know, where they work and with whom they worship are benefiting by what it is that you have been able to accomplish by God's grace in the lives of the people with whom you minister. And so they benefit indirectly. The vendors, people who sell you things, they benefit indirectly by your existence because they're selling something. I mean, you're there and they're buying, purchasing things from you, or you're purchasing things from them. And by virtue of that, there's some benefit that's achieved there. And then you have a third category, and that's what I call a fringe prospect. And a fringe prospect is essentially someone who has a geographic association with you. In other words, they live, they function in the same area where you provide your services. So that's you know, it's not very a strong association. I mean, it's wealthy people that may live in the communities where you provide your services. It could be corporations and businesses and, you know, people that, you know, have capacity to give, perhaps, but may not even know that you exist. But they're out there, and these fringe prospects do represent potential support for your organization in a variety of ways in which support could be rendered. So you have groups of people that are essentially nuclear, they benefit directly. You have others that are affinity, they benefit indirectly from the services you provide. And then you have those that you know, basically work, function, live in the same geographic area where you provide services. Now, there's a rule in development that's a really important rule to remember. And you may want to put a little section off to the side there and just write rules. And we talked about this rule yesterday, for those of you that were in our session yesterday. But it's the most significant rule of development is the rule of linkage. The rule of linkage. And the rule of linkage, simply stated, is this. The closer someone is linked to you, the greater the likelihood that they'll support you. In other words, if you were to look at individuals within the nuclear category and individuals or groups within the affinity category and groups within the fringe category, which would you guess would be the most likely to support you? And I think most of you would go up here and say, well, obviously the ones that are benefiting directly from the services that we provide. And then the further you go down the list, there's kind of the law of diminishing returns, right? I mean, you're not expecting that, you know, while there may be a lot of resources down in this fringe category, you know, people with capacity, there's very little linkage here. And so while there's a lot of resources down here, people who have the means of being able to support us, let's say financially, the likelihood is pretty unlikely by virtue of the fact that there's very little relationship there. Now, there are two kinds of linkage. So there's kind of an A and B under the definition of linkage. There's one kind of linkage, and that's called natural linkage. My sisters, I was born on Christmas Day. So I'm a Christmas baby, and I have two older sisters. And both of my sisters still believe in Santa Claus. I'm 60 years old, so they're in their mid-60s now, and they still believe in Santa Claus because they feel like that's the only rational explanation for their brother, you know, that somebody had to come from somewhere, land a sled on the roof, drop something down the chimney that showed up under the hearth of the fireplace on Christmas morning in 1944. Oh, there's our brother. But the realities are that I could look at my parents like they could look at my parents, and I could say, well, I'm the product of that relationship. You see, we're naturally linked. You have natural linkage up here. In other words, these people that we're, you know, ministering to, we kind of call them family members, don't we? You know, periodically we'll get together and we'll say, well, this is our ministry family. We all kind of are in this together. This is something that we're essentially committed together to do. So they're part of the family. Now, there's another form of linkage, however, and that's called created linkage. In other words, if my parents had chosen to adopt a child, bring them into the family, make them just part of our family through the adoptive process, they would be as much a member of our family as my sisters and I. Some of you perhaps have adopted children in your home, or maybe you are adopted, and you know, you see family pictures, and there's the whole family. And they don't distinguish. Maybe there are four kids, and we don't distinguish between, well, there's, you know, our two children, and those are just two that we adopted. No, you just say, well, this is our family. Now, there's an important concept there that you must remember, and it's very, very important from a developmental standpoint, so don't miss this point because it's a very significant developmental point. The great challenge of development, or certainly one of the great challenges of development, is this. How is the response to this question? How can I create linkage with groups of people with whom I don't have it naturally? Okay, now let me repeat that question because it's a question that you must answer. How can I create linkage with individuals with whom I don't have it naturally? How do I create linkage? And you got to answer that question. So let me give you some examples of how you might be able to create linkage, and we're going to kind of rush through this. I just want you to know that this is a seminar that typically I would take about 6 or 7 hours to do, so you're going to get the kind of the mountaintops a little bit, but hopefully we can glean some things out of this that will be really very helpful to you in terms of your ministry. And if you'd like to get a little bit more information on this, the pre-form session that I completed earlier, you might want to get that tape because I go into greater detail on each one of these points because we had about 4 or 5 hours to do it. So if you'd like to, you know, get that information, that tape would be probably really worthwhile getting a hold of. But let me give you some examples of how you might be able to create linkage. You might create linkage by asking people to pray for you, by creating a prayer partners network. You know, we're looking for 200 or 300 people who will choose to pray for us on a regular basis. And you might want to create a 30-day prayer guide, something that you could give to people that they could use to guide them through praying for you so that they can really pray intelligently for your ministry. Well, stop and think about that. You didn't ask for any money, but you did ask somebody to do something, and you gave them the opportunity of being a part of your ministry through praying for you. Let's say that you're talking to 300 or 400 people, and in that group of 300 or 400 people, 200 of that group are prayer partners. They've kind of linked to your organization by virtue of the fact that they're praying for you on a regular basis, and 200 others in that group of 400, you know, have no relationship with you whatsoever, and you're asking them to, say, volunteer for something. You know, you'd like them to be involved in something that you're doing. Well, which group is going to be more likely to respond? And the answer to that is obviously the prayer partners. Why? Because you've created linkage with them. In other words, the closer the linkage, the greater the likelihood. And so there's all kinds of ways that you could create linkage. Sponsorship programs are wonderful. You may have a way of being able to get people within churches in your area to quote-unquote sponsor one of your students or one of your clients. And again, it's an issue that varies depending upon the nature of your organization, but sponsorship could be, you know, we'll agree to pray for that student on a regular basis or that particular individual on a regular basis. We'd love to send them birthday cards and Christmas cards and just to let them know that we're thinking and praying for them. We'd like to, you know, periodically send them just a little note, you know, from us encouraging them at various points in their relationship with the organization to continue to grow and to continue to, and you know, maybe you try to get the sponsor and the sponsoree together periodically just to share what it is that that relationship has meant. But what have you done? I mean, again, they don't have to be fundraising things, but what have you done in this particular instance? You've created linkage with a group of people, and in consequently have increased the likelihood of really being able to build a solid, really meaningful, interactive, fulfilling relationship. One of the points that I made yesterday, and I've talked so much here lately that I don't remember where I said things, so you'll excuse me if I'm saying it again and you've heard it, but it's my belief, and I really believe this with all of my heart, it's my belief that literally people, you know, in general, are looking for something in which they can have a real fulfilling and meaningful relationship. People are drawn to community. They really are drawn. I mean, what causes a student when they go to a university to join a fraternity or a sorority, or what causes us to want to go to a church or to be a part of a club or to be a part of a group? And I think, you know, by and large, what it is we're looking for is we're looking for the fulfillment that's found in community and for the growth opportunities that are allowed through those kinds of relationships. And so what you're really seeking to do in the relationship building process is to create, you know, a community of supporters who have come alongside and are finding as much fulfillment in what it is that you are called of God to do as you find fulfillment. And that's going to demand a level of creativity on your part to really make sure that those opportunities are provided. But hopefully what I'll get you to do, if nothing else, is to get you to start thinking developmentally. Because that's, we have to kind of change our way of thinking a little bit when it comes to development. Because I know that what it is that we say and what it is that we do is so very, very important. And but what we need to do is we need to make sure that we have a place to be able to do what it is that's so very important to us, and that that ministry is stable enough to be able to support, you know, the long-term goals of what it is we've committed ourselves to do. So the key thing to remember here is that what you have in these categories is groups. That's a very important concept. I don't want you to miss that. You know, we're not talking about individual people here. We're talking about groups that make up nuclear prospects and groups, you know, that make up affinity prospects. It's a lot easier to implement development around developing strategies that are focused on groups. So you may have three or four strategies, you know, that you seek to engage this year with groups that you've identified as being critical to your success. And going back to identification, I let me just make another quick observation, because I realized that I'd forgotten something when I got to that point. I told you that a prospect isn't a prospect until you have their name and address written down there. But let me say another thing, that a very key component of the ways that you need to be thinking is ways in which you can get names. I mean, you're constantly in search of basically fueling, for lack of a better term, your developmental engine. And certainly one way in which you do that is constantly adding names to a database. So really search for ways in which you can get names. And there's all kinds of ways that you could do that. I mean, people, you know, that come to events that your ministry might sponsor. You know, get names and addresses. You know, ask them if they'd be interested in receiving a newsletter or something of that nature. You know, anything that you can do to try to get and gather names. Names can be found from directories in some instances. And I'm just suggesting a whole wide range of possibilities. In our country, there are fundraising activities that take place at a community level, you know, where the communities of America kind of get together once a year and raise a lot of money to help some of the other needy ministries or organizations that are doing good work. And you know, every year they publish a name, you know, publish a report that lists the names and of all those individuals that gave that year. Well, those would be names that would be worthwhile having. There are directories like foundation directories. We can help you with that a little bit in just identifying charitable foundations and trusts, you know, people that make contributions to organizations that have a profile similar to yours. And so those names are accessible. But you need to think about how we're going to get names. And, you know, referrals. I mean, I have my universe. I might be willing to give you my names of my parents or, You know, certainly churches, there are ways, we talked about that yesterday in our session that we had yesterday in organization, that your church representative program can be a very effective means of being able to get names of individuals within congregations who are kind of the movers and shakers, the leaders and so forth. So that's a very important concept. Okay, now let's go to the third step in the process. And the third step is cultivation. Now, cultivation, if we're using the analogy of falling in love, cultivation is courtship, you know. It's kind of fun, wasn't it? And those of you that can still remember that, and those of you that are still hoping for it, it is fun. It really is an enjoyable process of just getting to know someone. And, you know, you spend a lot of time together talking and walking and learning about one another, experiencing, you know, family members and other people that, you know, the person with whom you're building a relationship knows. And you just learn a lot, and it's really kind of fun. Let me draw a picture of a person here. That's a person with whom we'd like to build a relationship, you know, and it's one of perhaps several that may be on your database, people with whom you'd like to build a very, very personal and intimate relationship. Well, down here, there are some things that we need to know about that relationship or about that person that are very, very important to us in terms of ministry. One thing that we need to know something about is what I call vestiture. And think of vestiture as investment. That's a term that, you know, we all could relate to. And, you know, we make investments. Well, people make investments, too. They make investments of their time. They make investments of money. They may invest their child in terms of if it's a school, you know, to turn over essentially their child to you. They're investing you or in you by sending their child to your university or to your Christian school. So they could be church members, you know, if you're a church, I mean, people who have joined the church. They're basically saying, this is a church I want to be a part of. And so you have people that are vested or who have invested in your ministry, and then you have people that haven't invested. In other words, we'll call those non-investors or non-vested people. So you have vested prospects and you have non-vested people in your database. It's pretty important that you know that. I suspect that you would conclude with me that probably being vested or someone who's invested is better than being, you know, non-invested. And you're absolutely correct. Then over here you have some cultivation codes here. So every individual in your organization is in a different kind of relationship with you. Okay? You know, one of the big mistakes we make in development, and it's not just in organizational development. I mean, the realities are we make this mistake quite often in a lot of things that we do. I think churches make this mistake, or pastors of churches make this mistake all the time, and that is that they assume that everybody that's come to church on Sunday morning, and they don't assume this intellectually, but they assume it practically, at least in the way that they do ministry. They assume that everybody's in the same relationship to the Lord as the person sitting next to them in church. So we all come in, and we're all kind of carrying our own baggage, aren't we? I mean, we're dealing with issues at home. We're dealing with issues at work. We're dealing with financial struggles. We're dealing with it. And we all came in to church on Sunday morning, you know, carrying our own, you know, set of luggage, so to speak. And but how effective we are in ministry is going to be predicated on how well we know what those needs are. But if we try to address them generally, they'll probably be responded to generally. But if we have means by which we can really, you know, kind of hone in on the needs and the unique needs of an individual, we're going to be much more effective in ministering to them. And I think we would all agree with that. So let me suggest to you that in relationship to an organization, you have four categories of cultivation. We'll call them A, B, C, or D. You'll have some individuals on your database that you would say were really well cultivated. You know, they're A's. You'll have some that are, you know, pretty well cultivated, but you wouldn't put them in the same category as an A, but yet you know that they really love the ministry and they're really involved in what it is that you're doing and so forth, and so you might give them a B designation. Then you have some that you wouldn't put into the A category because they're not that well cultivated, and you wouldn't even put them into the B category because they're not really quite there yet. So let's call those C's. And then you have some that are D's. In other words, they're just not there at all. I mean, they basically may not even know that you exist. So it's kind of the interesting combination of these things that are going to really almost serve as a barometer, a success barometer on development. Because if you have a database, let's say, of 300 people on your database, and 295 of those are non-vested Ds, well, I mean, you could probably make a lot of prognostications, and my guess is that you'd probably be pretty accurate. You probably could determine that, well, they're probably not going to be very responsive to ministry if they're not that well cultivated, and you'd be exactly right. They're probably not going to be interested in making or even considering a contribution to your organization, and you'd probably be exactly right, because they've not invested anything in your organization in the past, and they've not been cultivated at all in any kind of a meaningful relationship. A number of years ago, we came up with an acronym in our ministry called AID, A-I-D. An acronym, each letter of the word represents another word, and in this particular case, A stands for attendance, and I stands for involvement, and D stands for donation. And so, you know, there are three things that people could do. They could come to something that you schedule. They could attend. It doesn't have to be a formal activity. It might be that they come to a breakfast, you know, with three or four other people. And so don't think that you have to have special events in order to attend something. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which people could attend something that your organization would sponsor. There are involvement opportunities. People could become involved. You might suggest that they be a volunteer for a particular project that you're working on, or you might suggest that they become a member of a task force to help you to address a particular issue for which you're really seeking to find answers. And they could become involved by any number of ways, volunteering for just working in the office or whatever the case might be. And then, you know, think of donation as somebody who makes a sacrifice on behalf of your organization. So don't think about it necessarily in terms of they gave you a gift. You know, they just reached into their pocket and they happened to have, you know, some money, and so they say, well, here's $1,000, whatever. And, I've got so many currencies in my pocket here. I don't even know which one it is. I have to look at this. This is a foreign, so this is Hungary. So there's some money, and I could say, well, here's some money. You know, this might be helpful to you. I've discovered that it might not be very helpful. You know, given this, it doesn't buy very much. I bought a cup of coffee this morning, and they gave me $500 back. So $500, whatever, will buy you a cup of a double espresso down at the local bakery here, just in case you didn't know. But basically what we're thinking about is somebody who makes essentially a sacrifice on behalf of your organization, some kind of sacrifice. Now, if they have done all three, they equal an A. If they've done two of the three, they equal a B. If they've done one of the three, they equal a C. And if they've done none of the three, they equal a D. So essentially, you could go into your database now, and you could probably say, okay, well, you know, these people have never invested anything, and they're probably a D prospect. Well, that's going to help you, because essentially, as much information as you can gather, you know, as much objectivity that you can bring to the table in terms of planning, the more effective your planning is going to be. And so here you've identified the fact that you've got some people that are better cultivated than others, and there are some predictability patterns that are really rather intriguing. You see, there's about a 0% likelihood that a D prospect is going to say yes to anything, including your invitations for them to respond in faith to Jesus Christ. I really believe that. It would be somewhat analogous to seeing someone on the street, you know, an attractive young lady who didn't happen to have a wedding band, and, you know, you're really attracted to her because she's really quite beautiful, and so you walk up to her and you tap her on the shoulder and says, well, honey, would you like to marry me? And she looks at you like you just got off a spaceship somewhere. She hits you over the head with her purse and says, get away from me. I marry you. I don't even know you. And yet we constantly kind of do those things. And I'm not suggesting the likelihood is about zero. I mean, I suppose we might say 1% or something if you feel like there's probably always the opportunity that somebody might respond. But there's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect would say yes, about a 60% likelihood that a B prospect would say yes, and about a 90% prospect that an A prospect would say yes. And so, you know, the lessons of development here are obviously, I think they're pretty obvious, aren't they? You know, number one, you know, we need to spend more time, you know, proactively cultivating relationships. And now you know a little bit about how to do it. You know, just get them to come to something. If somebody came to something, then the moment they come, then exponentially the likelihood of their ongoing involvement with you has increased by 30%. So, I mean, that kind of makes sense. And if you present to them an opportunity to become involved and they say, yes, I'd like to be involved, and all of a sudden, you know, this person that walked into your event, you know, as a non-vested D, walks out kind of a vested B, don't they? And exponentially, again, their likelihood of their participation in an ongoing way has gone from 0 to 60%. So, you know, just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. We need to be thinking about those things. I like to share what I think is one of the better ideas I've had in 35 years. I've been doing this for 35 years, and, you know, a number of years ago, I discovered, you know, a kind of a neat little way to cultivate people that has proven to be just exceptionally effective, not only for me, but for clients that we serve around the world. And basically, I call it a task force meeting, and I wouldn't suggest that you call that. I've got to come up with another name for this, but for the lack of another name, I'm going to call it a task force meeting. And the reason why task force is somewhat helpful is because, you know, basically a task force is basically a group of people that you assemble to accomplish a task. And so, you know, that's why I call it a task force meeting. But basically, it's not a committee. It's not something that you're establishing in an ongoing way in this particular example. But what I'm suggesting is that you bring groups of people together, or representatives of groups of people that you would like to build a relationship with. Now I must back off at least long enough to say that every group of people that you would identify as potentially being critical to the success of your organization, now hear me, because this is really an important point. Every group of people that you might identify as being critical to your success as an organization, every group has what I call critical members. They're the people that within the group others look to for direction. You have them in church, don't you? I mean, if I were to say, you know, who are the critical members of your church, you'd say, well, gosh, it's, you know, Fred and Larry and the Summerses and the Wrights. I mean, they are the people that everybody looks to for direction. So if you can identify those people, and if you could have the opportunity of sitting down with them, and it doesn't have to be as a group, and this is the point that I want to, you know, emphasize with you. You don't have to do this. You don't have to bring a group of people together. Now, you could do it in the context of a group. You could bring four or five couples together or four or five people together, but don't let that stop you. You could have one person who represents a group of people that you would like to build a relationship with. And let's say that's, you know, praise represents a group of people, you know, that I would like to build a relationship with. And the way that this meeting works is basically I sit down with Praise and I say, well, Praise, you know, it's really good to be with you, and I'm grateful for the opportunity just to, you know, chat with you. It's been a long time since we've had the opportunity just sitting down and talking. And I'd like to, you know, share with you a little bit about what it is that we're doing, you know, in our ministry. And you know, Praise, you know, I'm just really curious because you represent a group of people, you know, that might have an interest in, you know, what it is that we're doing. But, you know, I'm just sitting here trying to figure out, and that's honest, that's not, you know, something that I'm just saying for the sake of saying it, but, you know, we're just trying to figure out the things that we might be able to do to capture the imagination of the people that are part of your group. How in the world, if you were me and you were trying to communicate to the group that you're a part of, you know, golly, what would you do? And when you know that they understand the question, then just be quiet. Now, that's hard. Because we always, you know, silence is something that we feel obliged to fill. Okay, well, all right, I'll do something, you know. And so you say something, but just listen to what Praise has to say. And you know what Praise will tell you? He'll tell you exactly what you need to do. And you may want to ask clarifying questions. Are there people in the group that you would feel are kind of critical to our ability to be able to do this? And he says, well, yeah, I mean, you not only need to be talking to me, but, you know, I've got three or four of my buddies, you know, that you know, they kind of, you know, steer the ship, you know, as it relates to the group of which I'm a part. Well, gee, could we get together? Would you be willing to, you know, schedule a breakfast where we might be able to just to talk? I promise you, I won't ask them for money. I mean, what I'm really concerned about is how can we really engage you in ways that are going to be satisfying, fulfilling to you, and And at the same time, don't worry about the money. The problem, you know, in development is too often we lead with our need. Well, what our need is relationships. You know, don't lead with your need, you know. Lead with your vision for ministry and what it is that you want to do and the fact that you really need to engage people in what it is that you're doing. And you really like to provide opportunities in a variety of different venues for people to be able to join with you, to lock arms with you, practically speaking, so that you might be able to fulfill the mission to which you've been called. Well, you know, the reason I like that is because, you know, here's somebody, let's say that Praise is somebody that I don't have a relationship with at all, and maybe he's a non-vested D. But, you know, in one, you know, luncheon meeting or a breakfast meeting, for all practical purposes, you know, I could move that relationship from being a non-vested D to a vested B. He came to something, and, you know, maybe if I do that right, and I wish I could spend a little bit more time talking about, you know, what right means in this particular example, because I think it's not just what happens in the meeting, but it's how you end the meeting that's going to determine whether or not it's most profitable. But if I've done it right, the realities are, you know, he may leave a vested B, and consequently the likelihood of his ongoing participation now has increased from 0 to 60%. So that's just cultivation. And we need to cultivate. You need to court, so to speak. The next step in the process is solicitation. That's just asking people to become involved. And there are a number of factors that might go into this, and let me just kind of work through these real quickly in the interest of time. But there is a rule of communication, just like the rule of linkage, which is a really important rule. The closer the linkage, the greater the likelihood. There's a rule of communication, and the rule of communication, simply stated, is that one-on-one is best. In other words, you know, the best way to communicate to somebody is just go to them on a one-to-one basis and say, "Hey, Momir, I've got something I'd like to share with you." And I share with Momir, you know, what it is I'd like to share with him, and I'd say, you know, is this something that you'd be willing to pray about? Is this something that you might be willing to make a contribution to support, or whatever the case might be? But that's the most effective way of communication. The further I remove myself from the ideal, I'm talking to you all as a group, you know, typically what happens, especially if I'm talking about financial issues, all of a sudden everybody starts praying for one another. You know, "Lord, I just want to pray for Momir because I know he's got a lot of money," and Momir's praying for Victor. "Well, I know I pray for Victor because I know," and then Victor's praying for Peter, and Peter's praying for Andres. And I mean, everybody's praying for everybody else, and nobody's getting the point, but you're getting the point. And so the key is that you need to make solicitation personal. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't talk to a group. But if you're going to talk to a group, make sure that everybody in the group has something in their hands, maybe with their name on it, that basically you can hand to them and say, "This is something that I'd like you as a group to consider, and you all have a proposal that's got your name on it. I want you to realize that, you know, I'm talking to you individually as well as to this group. But let me share with you a little bit about where it is that we're going," and you kind of walk them through this, maybe this personalized proposal, something that you've written on behalf of that particular group in that particular event. "And here's what it is that we're asking you to prayerfully consider." And so we basically still use the rule of communication. You know, it's kind of interesting if you look at a hierarchy. You know, basically a one-on-one visit is best, and then you get two-on-one, which actually is not bad at all, for reasons that we were talking about yesterday. You know, because the linkage that may exist of the second person may be stronger to the organization than what you may have, and so having that person with you could be enhance the likelihood of, you know, a very successful or productive visit. But then you've got you know larger groups of people, you know, some smaller intimate gatherings like breakfasts or receptions or luncheons, you know, where you bring 4 or 5 people together. Those can be very, very effective. Then you get down to, you know, congregational appeals. Well, now we're kind of diminishing, you know. And then, you know, phone calls, actually, you know, one-on-one phone calls can be effective. And if you have supporters in the United States or outside your country, you know, getting a phone call from you can be very, very meaningful. But, you know, direct mail starts getting down to the bottom of the list because it's very impersonal. I mean, you can make a direct mail letter personal by obviously personalizing it and sending it, you know, with some kind of priority, giving it a first-class stamp in our case, or sending an email, you know, to us might be impacting, you know, causing me to open it or whatever the case might be. But there's kind of a law of diminishing returns, and I think you can probably, you know, figure that out on your own. But having a proposal can be really helpful, and we recommend that you do write up a proposal. If you need to see some examples of personalized proposals, I can send you some. I'd be more than happy to do that, give you some examples of how some things that other organizations have done. It doesn't have to be, you know, really super duper. You know, I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of money in doing something. Just something that you can put into your computer. And then, you know, you might want to insert the name of the individual in various places in that proposal. And so you can do a replace, search and replace function, you know, within your computer so that it can be personalized. And just have it there, you know, and then when you're getting ready to go out to a breakfast meeting or a luncheon meeting or whatever, just press the button, personalize it to the individual, and you give them something. You know, first of all, that's going to state your cause more effectively because you're going to communicate it probably better in writing than sometimes we can when we're in a, you know, a situation where we may be a little bit intimidated by the person that we're talking to. You've had that happen, haven't you, where you're talking to somebody that could buy and sell you about 20 times, and I've had those meetings, and I just walk in and I get scared, you know. So if I give them something and I have something, I feel secure because this gives me a level of security. You see, without that, I'm really kind of vulnerable. I feel like I'm just kind of a target, you know. But if I can give somebody something, that can be really helpful. So I'd recommend that you do that. There are typically two reasons why people don't respond to appeals to give. One is that we don't ask them, you know, which is pretty, you know, obvious. You know, why didn't you give? Because nobody's ever asked me before. Well, okay, now you're being asked. So we'll kind of, you know, check that one off the list. But more specifically, why people don't give, because I suspect that you've asked a lot of people to do things. And I'm not just talking about giving money. I'm just talking about, you know, why didn't you ever come to know the Lord? Well, nobody ever asked me to invite Christ into my life. Well, that's sad, isn't it? But you hear that periodically. Why didn't you do this before? Well, nobody. I thought some of Michael's examples in the evangelistic. I went into that network this afternoon because I really wanted to, or this morning because I really wanted to hear Michael. And the guy that led him to Christ, you know, he was relatively small, at least compared to Michael, who's, you know, relatively big. And he just kind of grabs him and he picks him up and says, "Why didn't you tell me this before?" You know, but I think, you know, the point is clear. But the second reason why people don't give is because we don't bring closure to the process, to the solicitation. Closure, in other words, you don't the process. Hear this, because this will make more sense to you. The process of solicitation isn't over until somebody says yes or no to you. In other words, you know, just the fact that you've asked them is good, but the process isn't over until they respond to you. By either saying yes or no. And so there are ways that you could do that. I mean, to encourage people to respond, you might suggest that, you know, could we hear from you by a certain day? You know, and usually put it out about, you know, 3 or 4 weeks from the time that you're talking to them. But, you know, we're hoping that you might be able to consider and pray and determine whether or not this is something that you could really get behind. And if you could let us know by June the 14th, we're going to have a board meeting on the 14th, or we're going to do something on the 14th, and it would really be nice to know, you know, who's really going to step alongside and be a part of this particular program. So it gives it, first of all, a level of urgency. I mean, that what it is that you're asking for, it's really important that we hear from you. And if you don't give it importance, they won't give it importance. And so giving it a date does give it importance. I mean, you're saying this is important. Another thing that you might want to do is if you have a pledge card, if you're asking people to, you know, give a pledge or to do something, is to put a number on that card. And I really would, if you're asking somebody for something, give them the means to be able to respond to you. They shouldn't have to go out and find a card or a piece of paper or something to write down what it is that you're asking them to give to or to respond to. So have a card, something that they can, you know, easily pick up and fill out and send it back to you. Well, put a number on the card, you know, like a 4,521. That's the card that's assigned to that particular person. And let them know that that's the number that's been assigned to them. And, you know, we're hoping that by the 14th of June we can get all these cards back. And, you know, if I don't see your card coming back, even if you can't give or even if you can't respond, and, you know, that's fine. We understand that because not everybody can do that. But If you'd still fill out the card and let us know, and that will just help us to know that you've really prayerfully considered the opportunity that we've presented to you. So you're giving it importance by virtue of the fact that you're saying, you know, it's important that we hear from you and that we've given a card that basically is assigned a number, and your number is 4,521. So that's some little thoughts on solicitation that could be really valuable. And then saying thank you, sustaining your constituents is the fifth step in the developmental process. So we identify people with whom we'd like to build relationships. Okay, we need to get names. You know, the whole process of development involves building relationships, but you need to build relationships with entities, people that you have a name and an address and a face attached to, people that you know. You're seeking to really engage in what it is you're doing. Then you want to qualify them. You know, well, where on the spectrum, at least right now, are they in terms of, are they nuclear prospects, are they affinity prospects? And, you know, you're not necessarily trying to change that, by the way. I sometimes an affinity prospect will always be an affinity prospect. And a fringe prospect will always be a fringe prospect just by virtue of who it is that they are. But just remember that in the nuclear category, you have nuclear A, B, C's, and D's. You have affinity A, B, C's, and D's. And you have fringe A, B, C's, and D's from a cultivation standpoint. So the goal of development is to move your D's to C's and your C's to B's and your B's to A's. And so rather than have one development program, you might have 12. You see what I mean? You might have four that would be focused on your nuclear categories. You know, bringing B's to C's, C's to B's, B's to A's, and doing something to really make sure that you're sustaining the involvement of A's and so forth. And so that's something to remember. But you need to qualify prospects. You need to cultivate them. That's really part of, you know, the courtship process. And then you need to solicit their involvement. And remember, we're not just talking about soliciting finances. We're soliciting, you know, their souls. You know, would you, you know, you just need to consider Jesus. Is that something that you've ever done? And would you like to do that? You know, that's part of evangelism, is asking that important question and really seeking to engage people that way. And then sustaining your constituents is really a key point. And if we're talking about giving here, and let me just say that my parents taught us something as children, and I always thought that what it is that they taught us was really very, very good. And I'd recommend the same to you, not only to your children, but, you know, adopt these same procedures as it relates to your organization. My parents would say, if somebody does something nice to you, then you need to thank them. Well, your parents probably told you that. But they told us you had to thank them three different ways. Three different ways. Now, the first two are always pretty easy, you know, because you could go to somebody and say, thanks. Appreciate it, Momir. Thanks. All right, that's one way. The next thing I could do is I could probably send Momir a note. Now, those were the first two that my sisters and I always did. You know, we'd send them a note, a little card saying, you know, thank you for Momir for your consideration. We just really love you guys and so forth, and I sign it. But the third one always involved creativity. Now, what am I going to do for the third one? And that's the one, interestingly enough, that's the most meaningful, because it takes a little bit of effort and a little bit of creativity. So saying thank you is pretty important, isn't it? And saying it really well. And so the third one might be inviting them to do something or sharing with them, maybe doing something special. If they gave you money and you spent the money to buy crayons and, you know, color a picture, you know. And we would do those kinds of things, interestingly enough, as kids. You know, we'd color a picture. And I colored these pictures with the crayons that you gave me, you know. And it was a nice way of being able to say thank you. And my parents were really pretty good to try to help us think through that third way. But they held us accountable to doing that. And I think that's probably a good practice, don't you? I just think that was really, really neat. So you can thank people, and that's really important. Let me just say that solicitation is not the end of the process. Or getting the gift. You know, it's not like we can say, well, we can check that one off because we got a gift. It actually is the beginning of a process. Think of it this way. All right? Here's a relationship. And I think this illustration really helps me. And I realize it's really pretty simple, but nonetheless, you know, this is kind of falling in love. So there's Jerry and there's Sue, okay? And there were a lot of decisions that were made along the way that basically, you know, drew us into a relationship. And that's true. I mean, you know, falling in love is a series of ever-increasing commitments. You know, will you go out for a date tonight? Well, that's pretty okay. Well, the next time you ask, or will you go out again? Well, she's got to evaluate that because she says, you know, she may be saying, well, if I say yes to him, he may think I'm interested. So she might say no if she's not interested. So that, and then, you know, would you like to meet my parents? Well, I mean, I took her to meet my parents. Well, now you're starting to really get serious. So there are these ever-increasing commitments. But there came a point in time when we committed to marry, okay? And this is, you know, we stood in front of each other. And we said, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until death was part. Is that the end? Oh, heavens no. No, heavens no. Now we're seeking to build a relationship of two people becoming one. And that means, you know, and what does that? I mean, stop and, because development, if you stop and figure it out, the realities are, it's the same thing. This isn't rocket science. If it was rocket science, I wouldn't be able to do it because I'm just not that smart. But the realities are, what brings two people together? Communication, involvement with one another, you know, doing things together. Not always with an agenda, because, you know, typically in ministry we tend to do things with one another, but it's always part of an agenda of something else. But the point is, that's what brings us together. Now, you know, in our society, you know, oftentimes, you know, marriage is kind of something that we know we should be doing by a certain age. That's the way it was when I was growing up. You know, in America, if you were 21 and you weren't married, people would begin to think, oh, are they okay? You know, and so, and that's kind of the way it was in our country. But, and so oftentimes, you know, marriage was looked at as a rite of passage. And so now you just lived your life as a married man, and she lived her life as a married woman. But this fulfillment aspect, which really guarantees sustainability in the case of a marriage, that you're going to stay married and not get divorced, that is as much a process as this. And it can't be neglected. So don't look at the gift as the end. It's really the beginning of a new kind of relationship that needs to be planned with the same level of enthusiasm and engagement as the first steps. Okay, let's take a few minutes for questions. And we rushed through that, and I apologize. If you really want to get the whole thing, the preform session, the tape of the preform session would actually walk through a little bit of this. You're going to hear a lot of the same illustrations, perhaps, but you'll get a little bit more detail because we had much more time to spend. Yes?
If you could come back to that picture of cultivation. I didn't quite get, would you in the database put both of those, like vesture and cultivation thing?
Yes.
And AID.
What I would do is if I were, the vested and non-vested, that's not as important, obviously, as the A, B, C, or D, because essentially once somebody does something, they're vested. Not necessarily if they attend, because they could be a non-vested C, because they've still not made any level of commitment to the organization beyond doing something that was basically emotional, because a lot of times coming to an event is an emotional event. So, but in a, if you're designing your web, your database, you know, and you can do that, and a lot of you probably do that. You use Access or some of database program. What you might want to do is you may want to have a vested, non-vested code. You may want to have a cultivation code, which may be, what I would do is I would have an attendance field, an involvement field, and a donation field, and then a cultivation field. Now, that's in an ideal world. So what you have is, this may be a drop-down menu, attendance. So you list all the things that somebody could attend, and you just kind of click on it if they attend something. The same way with involvement and the same way with donation. You're probably already doing that because you're recording, you know, gifts, you know, in your database already. And design this field, this cultivation field, based upon whether or not, in other words, the computer ought to just upgrade that automatically. If something's checked here in this field, and something's checked here, and something's checked here, it would automatically go to an A. And so that would be, you know, one way of doing it. Okay? Yes?
Does that person remain an A forever, for example, if they don't attend anything or get involved in the volunteers?
That's a very, very good question, and we really recommend, you know, that basically, you know, that you can maintain that data, but we really want to see activity listed, you know, on an annual basis, because we want to know if we're losing people through attrition. The one way that you can measure success in development, there's one objective way that you can measure developmental success, and it's very, very objective, and that's by tracking attrition. You know what I mean by attrition? You know, people who did something in one year that don't do it again in another year. So you can, you know, did you have donors that gave to you last year that didn't give to you this year? Well, if you did, you have attrition. And you need to track that in terms of a percentage. Did you have volunteers that volunteered last year that didn't volunteer this year? Okay, that's important to know. Because if you have volunteer attrition, then basically what that, and you're always going to have some attrition, obviously. But if you have, you know, an abnormal high percentage, say 12 to 15% or something like that, that's really starting, anything over 10%, and actually I think probably anything over about 7% is probably cause for alarm. And because what you're seeing is you're seeing people that are withdrawing. Why are they withdrawing? Well, it may be because of you, and most oftentimes it will be because of you, that you didn't really seek to engage them, and so whatever it was that brought them to the point where they became involved in the first place disappeared, and now they're just kind of left, you know, to figure it out themselves, if in fact they want to stay involved. So, there was a question back here.
Yeah. In the beginning you said that the kind of process of development is connected with relationship, and you said there is kind of an emotional level. What kind of role plays vision and goals to engaging people in these relationships? Because you mentioned that there is a kind of, you know, there's a friendship, yes, but when you would say what kind of role plays vision and goals?
Okay, I'm not sure. I was a little distracted there, so I apologize. I'm not sure I really understand the question, so I'm not going to try to answer what I supposed you just asked me.
Yeah, you said it's good, the process of development is connected with building relationships.
Right.
And you mentioned that there is kind of this emotional part because, okay, I know this person and I know that person. But I just wonder how much the vision or goals play a role in the building these relationships.
Well, I think the vision of your organization has a very significant role in terms of bringing people to the point where they might be willing to commit to do anything. In other words, tomorrow in the leadership network, I'm going to be talking about, you know, again, the role of vision in terms of the whole developmental process, because it certainly becomes the basis of strategic planning and so forth. And what you really, people don't get attracted to your need. What's really going to engage people is your vision. And so it does become an important part. And basically, essentially, what you're doing in seeking to build relationships is you're seeking to draw partners together with you to enable you to accomplish that vision. I was talking to some of the people that are working with a forum earlier, you know, some of the volunteers that are here and so forth. Now, let me tell you, these volunteers that are out doing the things that are driving you to the airport and doing, you know, selling the books and doing all of those things, they're just, you know, lay people. I know most of them. You know, they came from, you know, some of them came from my church. And I know those people. And you know, most of them, if you were to ask them, is there anything that you can do in your life that's going to have any kind of a significant impact upon the world, you know, most of them are just kind of roll their eyes up into their forehead and say, well, I don't think so. But look at us. I mean, here you have people from all walks of life who have given of their vacation time to come here to be a part of what it is that God's doing here. And these people are just, I mean, I'm talking to them, and they said, this is the most meaningful experience of my life. And here they are, you know, people with diverse abilities, diverse gifts, and so forth, who have come together, and as a result of their coming together, have been able to help this be a wonderful experience for all of us. They're serving us. And that's a, you know, these volunteers. Now, let me tell you something. If I were to, your first name again is, I'm sorry.
Nicole.
If I were to ask Nicole, let's say that Nicole is filthy rich. I know she's not, okay? But let's just say, but the realities are, even if she's not, let me say that I go to Nicole and I say, Nicole, you know, we're just going to all of the volunteers and we're hoping that, you know, this year you might consider, you know, a contribution of $50 over the year. You know, that's a dollar a week or something to help us with a forum. there's a pretty good likelihood, you know, that she's going to say yes. Why? Because she knows. She knows the value of what it is that God's doing here. See, everybody's looking for something that they can have a part in. And Nicole might think, well, I'm just a graduate student at Wheaton College. What part could I have? Let me tell you, there's an important part that you can have in enabling us to do that. And so she's involved. And so, you know, you don't want, and it's the vision. You know, what it's not the $52. That's really somewhat incidental. But we want you to be a part, you know, a continuing part of a continuing vision, because you know what happened, and it's going to happen again next year, and it's going to happen the year after, and so forth. We hope that this will always be a part of your life. Well, whether or not that happens, whether or not the forum and its ministry is a part of Nicole and her husband's lives after this year is going to be determined more on what I do than what they do. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, we need to lead in that relationship. And I need to make sure that I am continuing to keep her informed and to keep Kevin informed and to keep them engaged in ways that they can be engaged, because their situation is going to change. And I would hope that, you know, next year Nicole and Kevin are here again, and we can just grow in love with them, and they can grow in love with this ministry and what it is that God's doing. But that's going to be predicated on what we do, not what it is necessarily that they're going to orchestrate on themselves. Is that making any sense at all? Okay. We need to...
about 4 minutes.
Okay. Praise.
The last part of the instruction was that sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important that it doesn't end when you get your donation or whatever. And you've given us some steps, like the marriage thing, dating, meeting
mm-hmm.
parents. Are there any points you want to give us from that point forward, how to sustain?
Well, sustaining is really important. And think of, I mean, the best way to think about it, how do you sustain a relationship? You know, how did you sustain the relationship with your wife and grow that relationship after, you know, you left the altar? And so think about it that way. But communication is an important part. So you start treating donors as partners. You know, now they're not a donor prospect. They're a partner with you in ministry. So you start treating them differently. And you communicate that with them as partners. You perhaps ask their advice and, you know, in relationship to certain things that you may be doing. You seek their input regularly in helping you to, you know, understand them better and so forth. So, you know, communications that way, engaging them, doing things together, you know, bringing them together periodically and, you know, asking them to come to a campus activity. I don't know if it was you I was talking to this about the other day, but one of the organizations that we, Sue and my wife Sue and I support is the InterVarsity missionary on the campus of the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And interesting enough, our son went to the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs, and he was actively involved in the InterVarsity program there. And so the InterVarsity missionaries there asked if we had helped support them financially. And we wanted to do that because that was a kind of a neat way for us to be able to share in their lives and in something that was really impacting our son. And so that was like we started that 15 years ago, and we still continue to support them. They're still there, and we still send them checks every month. And but, you know, every year, you know, always kind of, it didn't annoy me. I was always appreciative of the fact that, you know, they wanted to thank us. And so every year, Todd would take me out to dinner. When we used to live in Colorado. We don't live in Colorado anymore. But so he'd always take me out to dinner. And I say, Todd, you don't need to take me out to dinner. He said, well, we just want to say thank you. I says, well, you've just said it. He says, and you're welcome. But he says, well, is there anything that we could do for you? And I said, you know, when you have a campus activity, why don't you invite Sue and I to come sometime? Because I'd just like to see what it is that's happening. Well, you know, he never did that. And I always thought that was a pretty good piece of advice. You know, and I can't imagine somebody not listening to me, you know, because I think what I have to say is profound. But that's me. That's what my wife says. She says, that's you, honey. It may be profound to you, but that doesn't mean it's profound for everybody else. But you know, you're doing retreats. Paul Eshelman, some of you know that name. Paul Eshelman, for years, was in charge of the Jesus Film Project for Campus Crusade for Christ. And Campus Crusade has been one of our clients over the years. And and we've worked with that organization. But one of the things that Paul does really, really well, you know, is he just, you know, if you gave, and usually it would depend upon the nature of the size of the gift in some instances, obviously. But if you gave a substantive gift, a substantial gift, a Jesus Film Project to help, say, translate the Jesus film in Mongolian, let's say, well, it might be very likely that, you know, Paul would call you and say, well, listen, I'm going to go to Mongolia for the premiere showing, and I'd like you to go with me. Well, let me tell you, talk about cementing a relationship for eternity. I mean, once people saw what it is that that ministry had and the impact that it had upon the lives of people, you know, all of a sudden these people are just ready to, you know, sacrifice everything, life and limb, you know, to make sure that that ministry sustains itself. And you could assume that nobody would want to go to a campus, you know, activity on a campus, or you could assume that nobody would really have any interest in going to a retreat and kind of just sitting in the background, or maybe even cooking or serving or doing something. Because, you know, Sue and I would have loved to cook breakfast or lunch or something. That would have been fun for us at a retreat. And they had a lovely retreat center in Colorado, but nobody ever asked us to do that. And you know, that's, I mean, our gifts were not, you know, huge by any stretch of the imagination, but nobody else was getting that invitation either. So kind of think about ways, you know, like that. Okay, Nicole? Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
No, don't leave. Don't leave.
We have form evaluations. I'm going to reiterate.